This is DeRay, and welcome to Posse of the People. On this episode, it's me, Miles, and Sharonda back to talk about all the underreported news with regard to race, justice, culture, and equity. And then I sat down with Brooke Butler, political director of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram at Posse of the People. Here we go. You've heard the headlines out of Venezuela. Now hear directly from Venezuelans on the newest episode of Runaway Country. Alex Wagner is on the ground talking with them about their hopes and fears for what comes next. Fabs and Ben Rhodes also joined to break down Trump's escalating imperial ambitions. Listen now on the Runaway Country feed or on YouTube and subscribe so you don't miss an episode. I'd hoped that 2026 would start off a little more chill, but it has not. We are back for another week of Pod Save the People. This is DeRay at DRY on Twitter.
This is Miles E. Johnson at Sun Pulpit on Instagram.
And this is Sharonda Bossier at Bossier Shay on Instagram at Bossier S on Spill.
Boom. Well, let's actually start with the news that has taken the country by storm, which is ICE, because ICE has just been causing havoc all over the country. But the story that really has gotten a lot of people who had defended ICE before, to even be outraged, is the killing of Renee Nicole Good, a 37-year-old white woman in Minneapolis. If you remember, the police also killed George Floyd in Minneapolis. That did change the country's attitude around policing in 2020. And now we have Renee Good, a 37-year-old white woman who was killed in Minneapolis. The police allege that she was using her car as a weapon. And if you've had the misfortune, like I did, of watching the video, you know that was not true. But they shoot her in the head at almost point-blank range, and she dies. And, you know, it was the middle of the day. There's footage of it. The FBI has taken over the investigation and has removed all local police from participating in the local in the investigation. They are not sharing any information with the local police department. The Minnesota National Guard has been activated because of what is happening with ICE. And then schools in Minneapolis have also been closed because ICE has been targeting schools. If you don't know about Minneapolis, most people know that Minneapolis has one of the largest communities of Somalians inside of the United States, but it also has one of the biggest concentrations of Hmong, of the Hmong community in the United States as well. I used to work at Minneapolis Public Schools, and we had 100 languages spoken in 70 schools. It was really an incredible place of cultural diversity. But I bring it here because Renee Good was killed, and then Keith Porter was also killed by an off-duty ICE officer in Los Angeles. And he was 43 years old, a 43-year-old black man who was killed by an off-duty ICE agent. But these two killings are the first killings of the year by ICE agents. And historically, ICE does not kill a lot of people in these situations. So it is alarming that they both have happened right now.
Yeah, I think what this really makes me feel is I wish that we were in a space where, like, a white woman's death wouldn't be in vain. Like, there would be an era in history where a white woman dying would mean something, would kind of get more attention, get more people to care, get more people to see how out of control something's gotten. But that's just not the truth anymore. The first person who came to my mind was Heather Heyer from Charlottesville, who passed away. So, you know, I do think that we are in, like, a culture of identity. So when you see something, just put it blunt, but when you see a white woman getting treated like a nigga, we're in a dark, dark, dark place. And I think, you know, we're recording this on the Friday after that shooting, after that incident. So, of course, I think the immediate reaction is alarming. The immediate reaction is people in the streets. But, you know, we'll see in 2 months what the reaction really is.
Yes, Miles, to that. And I also think that one of the reasons we didn't hear, or many of us didn't hear, about Keith Porter's death until Renee Good was killed was because we, as in the public, are still looking for the perfect victim. And so in talking about Renee, we've really played up, like, her wife, her children, her glove compartment, having all of the kids' toys in it, right? There's something about wanting her to be perfect and wanting to say, like, if they will kill this perfect person, right? Like, who else do you think they will take out? And in the Keith Porter instance, right, there are reports that he was shooting a gun in the air to ring in the new year, which if you were from Southern California, is a longstanding practice. It's a dumb one. It's an idiotic one. Stop it. But it is not something that should have resulted in his death. In fact, I don't even think most people get arrested for it when they do it. I think they get a citation for it, right? And again, it's dangerous. I'm not saying it isn't. But I think one of the reasons that people didn't talk about his death was because there is this sense that like he might have been doing something that warranted this off-duty ICE agent's actions. And Renee Good is as close to a perfect victim as we could get, which is why I think her death sort of set off this set of rallying cries.
Now, what I do think is different about this, and this I think is, seems to be one of the big catalysts. It's Mike Brown and Ferguson. Then we get George Floyd in Minneapolis and so many other killings, obviously, in between. So Sandra Bland, Rikia Boyd, Tamir. But these ones that sort of become these really long, sustained national conversations. What's interesting about Renee for me is you see these mayors come out and make statements about it. Mayors who are nowhere near Minneapolis. Mamdani is like, I called the White House. This is an affront. You know, he doubles down on the sanctuary city. The mayor of Minneapolis literally holds a press conference and says, get the F out of my city to the ICE agents. You see the sheriff in Philadelphia who is under fire right now because she is like, literally try that here and calls them fake law enforcement. Rochelle Bilal, the Philadelphia sheriff, is facing calls to resign after saying she would arrest ICE agents and calling them a, quote, fake law enforcement, adding, you don't want this smoke. It's like, this is an interesting moment where you see the police and you see elected officials, local elected officials, up against ICE publicly, which, I never thought I'd see that. We said abolish ICE and people said we were crazy. Like, this is nuts, da-da-da. And you actually see this happening in real time. I want to know if that, does that feel different to you? Does this feel like sort of just, these are the performances that happen and then people go back to business as usual?
I think it's the latter for me, that these are the performances that happen. I also think that this is, it's like the Derek Chauvin thing, right? Where it's like, there's got to be a sacrificial lamb, right? So this person is acting with the power, validation, justification of an entire system behind them. And what we are trying to do is say that one individual act is wrong, right? And the feds have locked out local and state law enforcement from investigating, right? Like Minneapolis City, the state of Minnesota have said, like, we don't have access to any of the evidence. The feds are there. The FBI has said, we will investigate. The vice president, the press secretary, everybody has already said, this guy's going to walk away. He will face no consequences. And so while I think it's important to be on the record as having dissented, right, you don't see anyone at, you know, moving in a way that says that the outcome will be materially different.
Retweet Sharonda.
Or Miles, we have 3 more years ostensibly of Trump, and it seems like ICE is just getting more intense. JD, I don't even saw the press conference. JD Vance said, and I quote, that ICE agents have immunity. Absolute immunity is what he said. So what's the end of this? Do you think it just is martial law? Do you think that there is a backlash in Congress? I don't know. What do you think?
I don't think that it's martial law. I don't really follow any of like the melodrama of what people kind of think is going to happen in their head. I think that you now know that ICE is like the police and they are another government system who can kill you if they want to. But when I really think about it, they're just joining a long country club of systems that can kill you if you want to, including your doctor, act black women, like, of course, including police officers. So I actually don't think that us having another established entity that can kill you with immunity is actually very new to American citizens. And I think that the shock of it being created creates protests, creates dissent, creates this. But I think in 3 months, 4 months, in 1 year, people get over it. Hence why we're still talking about this same thing over and over again. When we were talking about abolish ICE, abolish the police years ago, I've been doing a lot of kind of like feminist reading on BDSM and kink culture and seeing a lot of parallels in the BDSM kink culture. If last year was cults, this year is kink for me, and seeing a lot of parallels in just the psychology of what we do in the and the power dynamics and us restraining and resisting and saying no and then welcoming. So many Democrats welcomed ICE. So many people were collaborating with ICE before this. And unfortunately, it does not take one singular white person, and it damn sure don't take one singular Black person to stop those institutions. And that's what really needs to happen. And I don't think this is a catalyst for that.
Before we go, a little bit of levity on this, if that's okay. Y'all remember when we talked about the Vince Staples interview on Z-Way and how Vince Staples yes. was like, if Black people have our January 6th, we gonna look good, right? It's gonna be the Met Gala. Did y'all see the clip of the older Black man who was shouting at ICE yes. agents and his yes. firm? Yes.
He looked great too.
He looked great.
Yes. Yes. And I'm party pooper core sometimes. But even with stuff like that, it's because we're in this digital sphere. I'm super fascinated. My news this week is around AI and around, I'm so interested in now what people create. Now that they have the freedom to create everything and they just recreate the same thing that oppresses in the first place. So I'm also really interested in people, something happens, white woman dies. Oh, let's make this viral Black man in a fur coat go viral because we need our Bill Cosby. We need our Black daddy. Like we forget. Here go the kink, the Black daddy. We need the Black mammy. We need all of that in order to feel better. And I'm like, not only am I kind of tired of seeing Black people in the streets trying to resist this stuff, I'm also getting tired of seeing Black people digitally being used to assuage the trauma. I think people need to sit with the pain that you're in a neo-fascist hellhole and you don't need no Black joy or no Black man with the swagged out to make you feel better.
No Black excellence or rest is revolution?
I'm just going to say, I was into the optics of him being out there in his fur. I was into it.
Nat Ministry, y'all are my sisters. I love y'all. Y'all got, that shade was DeRay only. No, I give enough shade. I don't need no shade by proxy. I give enough on my own.
I was just trying to understand what is the revolution? I just wanted to know.
In seriousness, and not to say that those things don't still need critique, but I do think there's a difference between what you tell other Black people, other Black women versus what you tell all of America. And how I digest Rest is Resistance, how I digest the work of the Nat Ministry and other kind of Black feminist thinkers who have used Rest, that is a direct conversation with a Black woman. Because I talk to my mom every single week. I talk to my aunt every single week. These are Black women in their 60s who do not have it in them. They have seen enough. So I do think that just because something's popular because a Black woman created it doesn't mean that it should be employed to every single person who can hear it.
This is a push to understand. Is that how you feel about Black excellence, or do you feel differently about Black excellence?
I don't think Black excellence is a theory. I think it's propaganda.
Okay.
Rest and all that other stuff. There's books. I read the books. It's connected to other theories. I read Audre Lorde's Cancer Diaries. I read Beyond the Meme. Right? And there's something beyond the meme. Black excellence doesn't really live beyond the meme. And that's how come the Diddy documentary is so good, because when you look beyond the meme, you're like, I think that what we meant was the wrong E word. I think that we've been celebrating Black evil. I think that is what really has gotten power in an evil system is Black evil, that we can dress it in gold and bling it out. Yeah, I haven't seen any, like I'm like the Talented 10th. Mm-hmm. Like that, I can't think of any like Black excellence theories like that.
I am interested in what happens with the midterms. And, you know, I think that ICE has been so out of control that I do think if we can win back the House, I think there can be real pressure to force a rollback of ICE. The question is, like, how much will they roll back? I don't think this Congress will delete ICE. And I was actually shocked at Hakeem. I mean, I shouldn't be shocked, but Hakeem Jeffries was unwilling to use the budget process that they're going through now as a way to cut some funding from ICE. Like, he wasn't interested in that. But I do think that if we can get Congress back, even, you know, I don't know if you saw, but the healthcare vote with Lauren Underwood's tax mm-hmm. credit vote that just went through, Republicans joined her on that. And I do think that, like, I think that there's enough backlash to ICE that if we get close to a majority, I think that we will win on the rollbacks. I also am interested, and I don't know if you have anything to say, but I'm interested in, will people and communities make a distinction between ICE, or will they, like ICE and their local police departments, given that the local police are making distinctions now, so they don't get lumped in as like the police are bad? Or do you think people experience law enforcement as sort of like one and the same? I'm interested in what you both feel about that just because I don't have a good sense of it. Because ICE isn't really in Baltimore and I haven't seen them in Harlem. So those are the two places I'm the most. And I don't know how people feel about it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I live in Los Angeles. and shout out to LAPD for always giving us something to talk about or write about.
Can't we all get along? Sorry.
Yes.
LAPD, Rodney King, I don't...
Yes, sorry. No, I'm exactly where you're going. I don't think people are drawing a distinction, right? Like, LAPD is still LAPD, you know? And I think for everyone, it feels like yet another layer of occupation. You'll also recall that at the height of the pandemic, right, at the height of the 2020 protests, the National Guard was deployed here. Like, Los Angeles, particularly the hood, is used to being occupied. And we're not drawing distinctions. And no one is thinking about what this law enforcement body has a right to do versus this law enforcement body. You know what I'm saying? There is likely a white man with a gun standing in front of you telling you to do something. And I think it's setting off the same terror, no matter the color of their uniform or the shape of their badge.
You can't really afford to draw a distinction, right, when you're a part of certain racial classes. Because the pattern is, if the state sanctions a group of people to be able to police a community or be able to police people, there are going to be people who are inside of that state-sanctioned organization who are in there simply for the fun of the cruelty of it. Mm-hmm. That's just the truth. That's just what is inside of all of these places. So if you are a brown person, if you are a visibly queer person, I would say as somebody who is failing gender, which puts you somewhere inside of the trans community, welcome. And obviously, if you're a black person or any of those intersecting places, you know that at any moment you might be meeting somebody who's in it for the cruelty of it. Mm-hmm. And that's just something that is rotted and infested in all of these organizations. So you can't really afford to draw a distinction because it's all a gamble, including if that person looks like you. I'm probably more scared of a cop with a rainbow badge who's black like me, because I'm like, now what you got to prove in order to prove that you down with them? And now that you see me, you got to prove it. Sorry. So when my one interaction with the police, and this came to me, was somebody who was light skinned, was queer, I found out later, was gay, a gay male, found out later. And because how I was dressed, they tried to get me in trouble for soliciting sex outside of the club.
Oh, no way. When was this?
I had to be like 23. That might also be the size of my waist at that time too. Hence the, no, I'm joking. But no, but that was such a strange moment because, I've never engaged in like sex work in that fashion at all in my entire life. I was outside of the club, 23, whatever. And in that moment, I kind of thought I would be able to talk to that person and let them know, like, I'm just in the club. I know I don't got no clothes on right now. You know, no clothes on for me. I've always been a modest queen. But I was like, I don't have any clothes on because I'm just out here trying to, you know, catch a break or whatever. And there was no empathy. There was no sympathy. And it was just as hostile, you know? Anywho, that was just something that came to me around this idea about police.
Can I say something about the people who were in it for the cruelty of it? You know, when ICE was making its sort of most recent big hiring push, people were like, oh, we're going to end up in this situation where the only people who try to work for ICE are people who are in it for the cruelty of it. And what people are on the right are trying to do right now with Jonathan Ross, who is the ICE agent who shot and killed Renee Good, is say that he's not a new hire. He's an experienced agent. So you all were worried that it was going to be some like rogue new person, right? But this is an experienced ICE agent. And he did this because he literally was afraid for his life. They've also told us already that he was dragged by another vehicle last year, right? So that they're already sort of paving the road for like excuses around like he was traumatized previously by being dragged by a vehicle. He's an experienced agent. And so if he felt threatened and he felt unsafe, then, you know, this was the right call. The other thing that they're doing is pointing out that he's married to a Filipina. And that also is very telling, right? So because we have talked about ICE as this sort of white supremacist, racist enforcement arm, they're going to drag out his Asian wife too, right? And so all of this, when you talked about people who were in it for the cruelty of it, again, I think a lot of that public narrative had been focused on people who were recent recruits. And they're like, no, this guy is a longstanding agent with a good reputation and a good record and an Asian wife. So y'all can't see their faces.
I will say too, it is, you know, we did this big campaign in 2020 called 8 Can't Wait. It was about use of force policies. One of the policies was banning shooting into moving vehicles because the police do this all over the country. We actually got the DOJ to change their policy, which included ICE, to limit and ban shooting and moving vehicles. So when this happened, people immediately were like, this is against the policy. And we were like, we know, because we wrote that. But it was, we were trying to, you know, the news has covered some of the bans. They conveniently make it sound like the bans like on shooting moving vehicles just popped up. That it was not activist-led. It was not just me. It was a lot of us who did it. But it is interesting because, and you know, this is my day-to-day work, but the police do things like this in ways that people just don't, they don't become national story. Most of the killings happen not like this that make the national news. It's like somebody running from the police or walking down the street, da-da-da. But the police shoot at moving vehicles all the time. And it is one of the craziest things because you're like, you know, I don't know if any of you have ever seen somebody shoot a gun or you shot a gun or been around a police officer shoot a gun. Very few people can aim. It is, aiming is harder than people think. It's not, you know, we don't have a lot of, like, shooters in communities aren't good aims, which is why they shoot bystanders. The police are not good aims. That's why if you ever ask, like, why don't the police just shoot people in the leg? It's because they can't figure it out. They go for center mass because that is it's the biggest part of your body. When you shoot at a moving vehicle, if the police can't shoot somebody standing still, they certainly can't shoot somebody accurately driving away. This is why they shot her point blank. Like, she wasn't really moving the car when he shot her. So when they try to do the, like, well, the car was moving, you're like, the car wasn't coming at you. It wasn't really acting like a weapon. But the lies that the police tell, this goes to our story from last week about why they want to make sure that people can't film the police. Because the only reason people could push back on the killing of Renee was that there's 8,000 videos of it.
Yep.
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Stay tuned, there's more to come. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Now, here's the thing. I don't love when people say new year, new you. I don't need you to be a new you, but I do want you to be a less burdened you. I want you to be a more supported you. I want you to be a you that is choosing every day how you show up in the world and a you that knows that you don't have to do any of this alone. I'll tell you, 2025 was good in a lot of ways, but I had some moments that were like real shaky. And the cool thing about all of the shaky moments is I didn't have to do it alone. Therapy really is a game changer because there's somebody who's not in your day-to-day life that you are able to talk about everything that's going on. I can't recommend it more. It was a game changer for me. I went to therapy when I was a kid, and then I didn't go for a long time, and Lord knows I started back up in 2020. That's why I'm here to recommend BetterHelp. BetterHelp therapists work according to a strict code of conduct, and they're fully licensed in the U.S., and they have a matching process that makes sure that you are matched with somebody who can meet your needs. And they have 12-plus years of experience and industry-leading match fulfillment rate, which means that they normally get it right the first time. And if you aren't happy with their match, you can switch to a different therapist at any time. They have over 30,000 therapists, and BetterHelp is one of the world's largest online therapy platforms, having served over 5 million people globally. And it works, with an average rating of 4.9 out of 5 for a live session based on over 1.7 million client reviews. BetterHelp makes it easy to get matched online with a qualified therapist. Sign up and get 10% off at betterhelp.com/people. That's betterhelp.com/people. This podcast is sponsored by Squarespace. Now, I've been a Squarespace user ever since 2014 because I needed a way to build a website and make it easy, make it look nice. It could be whatever I needed it to be. So I'm a Squarespace lifer. And what's great is that Squarespace gives you everything you need to offer services and get paid all in one place. If you have a business, whatever type of website you want to put up, they got you. And for people who have businesses, from consultations to events and experiences, showcase your offerings with a customizable website designed to attract clients and grow your business. Get paid on time with professional on-brand invoices and online payments. And you can streamline your workflow with built-in appointment scheduling and email marketing tools. Now, you don't have to do this alone. They have a new part called Blueprint AI, which is Squarespace's AI-enhanced website builder. And you can use it to get fully custom websites in just a few steps. They will use some basic information about your industry, goals, and personality to generate premium quality content and personalized design recommendations. Squarespace also offers a complete library of professionally designed and award-winning website templates with options for every use and category. No matter where you start, your website is flexible to what you need. With intuitive drag-and-drop editing, beautiful styling options, unrivaled visual design effects, on-brand AI content, and more ways to list what you offer. No experience required. Get discovered fast with integrated Squarespace SEO tools. Every website is optimized to be indexed with meta descriptions and auto-generate sitemaps and more. They really got it figured out. Head to squarespace.com for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/PSTP to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. That's squarespace.com/PSTP. Well, to talk about Trump some more, because we are in this hellhole of his administration. Remember last week you talked about Mikado, who was the opposition leader who got the Nobel Peace Prize, who praised him so much, and that he was like, she not ready to be the leader of Venezuela. The idea that Trump should be choosing the leader of Venezuela is insane. But I don't know if you saw. So Trump is trying to get the Nobel Peace Prize tomorrow. I'm interested in why you think he cares about the Nobel Peace Prize so much. But they have released a statement that said, a Nobel Prize can neither be revoked nor transferred to others. Once the announcement of the laureate has been made, the decision stands for all time. As for the prize money, the laureates are free to dispose of it as they see fit.
I don't know why he's so obsessed with the Nobel Peace Prize, right? Also, she's tried to appease him in a number of ways around this. First, she dedicated it to him, right? And that wasn't enough. He like needs to possess it. And that's why we saw the FIFA Peace Prize, which they created to give to him. I don't know why he feels like he needs every award in all the land, you know? But I do, you know, recall when she was awarded the Peace Prize that there were some people who took real issue with her proximity to the Trump administration, right? Who were like, we don't disagree that Maduro needs to be replaced, that he shouldn't be here, et cetera, et cetera. But this is not the way to do it, especially cozying up to this administration. So the idea that she's coming to the United States next week to meet with him, he's saying it would be an honor to accept the award from her. I don't know why he's obsessed with it. You know, I sort of understand her play if she wants to be installed as the leader of Venezuela. And arguably, she can say she won an election and therefore, even though she's being installed, she's a legitimate leader. I see the argument she might make there. But like in no democracy is that how shit is supposed to work.
So back to my point on cruelty, right?
Yeah.
So specifically for them, when we connect everything that people are doing with the Epstein files, when we kind of remember what Trump did to that white woman in Bergdorf Goodman, she won her case. Like, you have to understand that, and I'll even connect it with Diddy, you know, because that's like kind of the latest pop culture thing on people's heads. The cruelty is fun and it's sport. So the same thing that makes you want to humiliate or rape a 12-year-old, 13-year-old, 14-year-old, 15-year-old girl, and the thing that gets you excited about that is the same thing that makes you want to take something that you didn't get from a woman, whether it be her Nobel Peace Prize or her sexuality. It's all fun and it's all in the same game of power. So how he does it expresses itself different ways. How he does it is different, but it's all the same. Grab him by the pussy, grab her Nobel Peace Prize. That's their game. They're sick in that way. Even when I think about Pete Hegseth and when you read about what he's done and the kind of person he is, and we all kind of met a bro-y frat person who you might be scared to be alone with in the room. That is their thing, you know? Why do serial killers end up killing their pets before they do stuff? It's something differently wired in your head around it. And the other thing too is, I don't think it's really about the Nobel Peace Prize. I just think that he's a glutton. I think that just like somebody who's a glutton wants a burger, and then after the burger, they want the ice cream, and then they want the steak. I think that, you know, I want the presidency, then I want the Nobel Peace Prize. It's just status burgers that he can eat. And once that status burger is done, he's going to try to digest another status burger, and it might come in a different expression. It might look like an invasion of a country or taking of an award, but it's all to get that status because he's an empty person.
It is really interesting how, you know, remember that he got the FIFA Peace Prize, which was made up and means nothing. The Nobel Committee, he's never going to get that earnestly. So he's trying to do it this way. And Miles, I do agree with you in that sense that, like, you know, one of the features of white supremacy, right, is that there's never enough. And they know they can't earn the stuff, but they want it anyway. So taking it is second best, and they will do that until the end. I don't live as public of a life as I did in the beginning of the protests, but I look up and I just see so many people who, I wish this many people were informed in 2014 and 15. I look up and so many more people have an understanding of race and justice in a way that they did not, but are paralyzed about what to do about it. And I'm hopeful that some really good organizing comes out of this. So like Mamdani is a great example of like how we get people in structural power, but Mamdani only is able to win because a whole group of people before him laid the philosophical framework for an election like that. So shout out to the organizers and let's keep going. Miles, MTV, is it gone? Is it here? What's the what?
I will apologize for whoever reported the news that MTV was gone. No, in all seriousness, y'all, I was very adamant and annoying about setting a public apology around MTV being gone because MTV is not gone. So, you know, those like stations like MTV Classic, MTV 2 or whatever, those stations are disappearing, but just only in UK and Australia. And one of the reasons why I was adamant about us apologizing around it was because, A, we take seriously giving you all right information, specifically in the age of misinformation, but also because we weren't the only ones. Even as I was kind of like retroactively looking at all the posts around MTV dying, you have Exhibit, who's the host of Pimp My Rides, putting out Carson Daly crying and saying goodbye, AI generated, by the way. So you have all of these people who were participating in saying goodbye to MTV, which means something that was not true, grew legs and infiltrated our news process. And that means if it happens to us, and we are a pretty well-resourced podcast, if it happens to us, that means that it can definitely happen to you. So I'm all about looking things twice. I put pictures, I call them my auntie and unk checks. I put pictures of two AI pictures and say, which one's AI? Sometimes they're trick questions. Like my last one, they were both AI because it's getting even better. And even when it comes to stuff that feels so ubiquitous, because by the time the news happened with MTV, it felt ubiquitous. So it didn't even cross my mind to check to see, because it was on places that we trust. When you went down to it, it was one of those things where that's not what's going on. And unfortunately, we have so many people desperate to make money, desperate to have a news story, that comes first for a lot of people. And yeah, we're sorry, but also let this be a warning that if it can get us, it can get you.
Yes. Although I think our points about MTV's declining cultural power and influence remain.
It definitely still remains, but with the context of nothing changing, it's something that we could have said 20 years ago, too.
For sure.
Did you also see that Trump has finally acknowledged that Diddy did request a pardon, and Trump said he has no interest in granting a pardon?
Yes. I wonder if he would feel differently if the sentence were longer, or if Diddy had been convicted on the more serious charges, versus being like, you can suck it up and take this sentence on the chin, you know?
Sometimes I'm like, because I feel like I pushed back on him giving a pardon a few times. And I said, well, maybe if Diddy really played the game, like went full Nicki Minaj and really just like surrendered himself to Coonland, I can see that happening. But my idea is that Diddy, no matter what, still has a better bet inside of the Black community, even after this stuff has happened. So I don't think that he's going to be doing that. And all of this, it feels stupid me saying it, so I'm sorry, but maybe it needs repeating. This is all racialized. Like, you know what Nick Fuentes was saying about J.D. Vance's wife and like being like, you can't tell me nothing. You married to this slur word who's brown, like a brown slur word. Like, it's so about making sure, oh, a rich Black man is in jail with no money. Great. More money for white people. Like, they're already in a racial cultural war, and these systems are their nuclear weapons. And him doing that in front of people just wouldn't make any sense to them unless that he was able to like be a mouthpiece for white supremacy, which I feel like Diddy's like, I can't do that.
You're like, draw the line there.
Tyler Perry still touching and writing checks. Touching them boys and writing checks. Tyler Perry is, so Diddy don't gotta totally oblige to white supremacy right now. He still has other pathways.
Well, I look forward to hearing whether or not you turn a profit on Kaushi when you bet on the potential outcome of this.
Hold on, let me get my app.
What's crazy is I didn't even know Kaushi was a thing or Polymarket until the podcast. Like I'd seen like the tweets and stuff, but I like couldn't like super make sense of it. And now I'm like, oh, this is really not good.
Yeah.
That's what makes it so good because it reminds me how Uber came. So I don't know. Yeah. So I remember very clearly the integration of Uber. And at the time it was Caviar, which was like the food service. Mm-hmm. And I remember it just kind of like came. It wasn't like a big old shout. It just kind of came. And then before you knew it, you're like, oh, we just all do this 5 years later. Yeah. That's how this Polymarket stuff kind of comes in. It's not coming in like AI or about Bitcoin. It's kind of coming in and just integrating with our life already.
Yeah.
I was at dinner with the guy who started Uber. And we're sitting next to each other. This is very random, but and you never know with him. So we're all at this dinner, and I'm like, "What do you do?" He's like, "Oh, I like started a tech company." I'm like, "Oh, what tech company?" I like, "I don't know." He's like, he is being very coy about it, very sweet. And then it's Uber, and I ask him, I'm like, "Why?" And he was like, "You know, I used to call the cab companies, and there was such a mess in New York City, so I call all of them. I just call like 3 cab companies to come get me." And then 2 would come, but I'd be gone already because one of them, like, I just go whoever came first. So he's like, eventually my address got banned. So none of the cab companies would come to my address anymore because I would call it like that. So he was like, I started Uber because of that. And I was like, that's interesting. It's my random Uber story.
You know what? I want to predict and prophesy. So anybody who has more stick-to-itness when it comes to tech and where tech is going than me, please steal this. But I think there's going to be, specifically once this Trump era is over, there's going to be like a wave of like woke apps. So what I mean by woke apps is essentially like way more successful Ubers and Lyfts that do background checks, like feminist, socialist versions of things that we already have. So I think that's going to be like a huge wave that comes by because most Americans want to feel like they're doing something and they're going to feel guilty for letting this happen. So instead of doing something, they're going to consume their way into feeling better about it. And that consumer is going to happen via apps, is my prediction.
Polymarket that.
And book clubs.
You know, we're going to pilot some teaching stuff for February, so look out. I'll go to the news. I'm starting with the great state of Utah. So in Utah, it is interesting because they have now made it legal for prescriptions, medical prescriptions, to be done via AI. And, you know, I'm torn about the AI thing. I'm like, I just am nervous about it for a host of reasons because I think that especially medical care, people should have a doctor. You know, AI is not a person. AI is just culling the mass of information that's been put into the system. But in reading about it, I was actually split. So I'm interested to know what you think of. The FDA is not currently regulating AI. So this is really the Wild Wild West right now. Like, it is unclear what the rules are, or they get to make the rules up themselves in the great state of Utah. So I hope that there is some regulation, even if we allow this to happen. But one of their arguments for it was that in places where there are not pharmacists or where there are not a lot of doctors, this actually is an access issue, and that this will allow people to get prescriptions refilled and things like that in a way that makes sense. The company is called Doctronic, and they compare their AI system to human clinicians in 500 urgent care cases, and they show that the treatment plan matched the physicians 99.2% of the time. 500 people is, you know, a small sample when it is people's lives at risk, because, you know, you screw up 1 or 2 prescriptions, 1 or 2 people, and all of a sudden, that is a wrap. And of course, as you can imagine, the Doctronic co-founders are saying AI is actually better than the doctors at this. And I quote, when you go see a doctor, it's not going to do all the checks that the AI is doing. So like, I'm so fascinated by that. But I also am like, this makes me a little nervous. The program in Utah is limited to 190 commonly prescribed medications. So there are a host of things that are excluded. So like pain management and ADHD drugs, for instance, still require a person. As you can imagine, this is a profit-making business. So there's a $4 per prescription renewal price. So, you know, you don't always have to pay something like that when you go to your doctor just to get a refill or a prescription. And I was actually pretty surprised that this is regulationless. Like, I'm not surprised by the Trump people, but I had just sort of assumed there would be some, I don't know, some safeguards that would prohibit something like this just happening so easily. Like, Utah's just like, hey, we're drying it out. And I think as a consumer, I would just assume there's some medical board that is putting guardrails up for this. Like, I would not think that the company itself is doing it on its own. So I wanted to bring it here because I'm fascinated by it. And I'm nervous about it.
I'm terrified because I'll just talk a little bit about my own health journey. I think I've shared before that I have hypertension. It's something I have inherited. I am on meds for it. It has taken me a long time to find the right meds, right? So the first meds I was on made it really difficult for me to run. And I'm a distance runner. Like, that was like my well-being. So I was like, okay, can't be these meds, right? Next set of meds I'm on, my doctor is like, I know you say you don't want to have kids, but there's this whole other class of medicine that I don't want to prescribe for you because it impacts you if you decide to, my body, my choice, but that's a different conversation too, right? So they put me on a second batch of meds, right? My hair falls out. Then they put me on a third batch of meds. I end up hospitalized with angioedema because they don't know why, but like 2% of Black people who end up on this set of meds, right, end up with swelling in like an extremity. Unfortunately, the swelling in my extremity was in my face. And so my best friend was a clinician. And when I started to feel unwell, I called her. And she was like, take a Benadryl. And if you still don't feel well in 30 minutes, like, call me back. What I didn't know is that she was on her way to my house because she knew, based on what I was describing, that things were about to get really bad for me. So I get to the hospital because she's like, get in my car. I get to the hospital. I'm masking, right? It's 2022. They asked me to pull my face down. I'm also delirious from the Benadryl, or pull my mask down. I'm delirious from the Benadryl. I have no idea what's happening. And everybody is panicked for me, right? But my blood pressure was fine, right? And everything that WebMD told me, which is also mostly scraping things from the internet, right, was that I would be fine. And I'm going to put in the group chat right now what my face looked like when I made it home from the hospital so y'all can see how bad my swelling was, because this is what I looked like when they released me, right? But if I had not had easy access to someone who was a clinician who understood what I was describing was about to get worse, I would have been on my couch taking a nap. This terrifies me. Y'all can't see Miles's face, and y'all also can't see the photos, but it's, yeah.
I remember this, Sharon, and I was like, this is crazy.
Yes.
I mean, no version of what we will say will communicate what's in this picture.
Yes.
I'm so glad that I did not know you at that time, because I'm not that nephew. I'm not that niece. If you want somebody to panic with you, I'll panic. But I'm not that whole knowing someone was going down and coming to your house. That is so beautiful. I would have been like, oh my God. I couldn't even describe to you, but it looks wild. It also looks like the picture I need to show when I get my fillers, though, because that looks about the right size for my lips.
Miles, you are nuts.
Yeah, so I'm in a weird place when it comes to this, right? So because of the story that Sharonda just told, but also so many stories that I hear about Black people who are interfacing with the medical system in general, it kind of feels like, so I can even connect this with the kind of the AI in music argument, where, yes, do I think AI in music is bad? Do I think that it's stealing? Yes. When I hear the music that AI creates, because it's bad, it does make me think about all the mediocre, bad music that made this possible, because there are people who are listening to it whose ears have been trained to consume bad music. So I think about all the people who, I don't know how to say this without being mean, but all the people who gave us music in order to make a dollar, and now we figured out how to take the people out of the music, and now it's just music and a dollar. And I think about that when it comes to the medical industry too, because I know so many people who didn't get the service they need. So it's like, okay, plug it into a robot. Maybe that'll help. Like, it's hard to create the same type of urgency around this because the medical industry has already been so bad to the participants already. So what's making it automated?
Yeah, it blew my mind. And Sharonda, you're right. The hard part is that I worry that people are going to get hurt before there will be regulations for this as opposed to on the front end. I put somebody saying like, okay, we can give out Tylenol like this and we can give out some vitamins like this. We shouldn't be giving out heart pills and blood pressure pills. And, you know, like, I'm still shocked. I've really overestimated government regulation. Here we are. Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Stay tuned. There's more to come. Pod Save the People is brought to you by Blinds.com. If your blinds are outdated or broken and you don't have time to tackle fixed windows on the list, Blinds.com is for you because they make it simple to refresh your space without the hassle. Now, let me tell you, my bedroom, I love my apartment, but I didn't have blinds for a long time. Need blinds. So when the sun comes up, it just is bright, not great. Like, I needed something to put up, but who knows how to shop for blinds? I don't know. I didn't know how to do it. But that's where Blinds.com's come in because they called out the window treatment industry for what it was. It was outdated, overpriced, and built to serve salespeople, not customers. So they flipped it. While others may overpromise and overcharge, Blinds.com delivers custom window treatments for your space, your way, at your convenience. Now, some competitors, the price you see is not the price you pay. But with Blinds.com, the price you see is the price you pay. No hidden fees, and there's zero pressure. Whether you want to do it yourself or let the pros handle it or something in between, Blinds.com gives you options so you're in control. Need help picking the right look? Blinds.com's design experts are available on your schedule with free consultations. And if you want the full white glove treatment, they can even schedule licensed, vetted pros to measure your windows at no cost, and they'll install everything for one low price. Blackout curtains, motorized options, classic shutters, they have everything. And it's backed by Blinds.com's 100% satisfaction guarantee. So you know you're covered, literally and figuratively, because at Blinds.com, the only thing they treat better than windows is you. The Black Friday deals at Blinds.com are going strong all month long, so don't miss your chance to save big. And as always, our listeners still get $50 off when you spend $500 or more. Just use code PSTP at checkout. Limited time offer. Rules and restrictions apply. See Blinds.com for details.
If you love Pod Save America and want more of my political analysis, you should subscribe to my newsletter, The Message Box. I'm Dan Pfeiffer, former senior advisor to Barack Obama, and in Message Box, I break down what's actually happening in politics and what it's going to take to beat Donald Trump MAGA. If you follow every poll and every twist and turn in the campaign, Message Box is for you. This isn't just hot takes. Every edition delivers clear analysis, behind-the-scenes insight, and practical strategy you can actually use, whether you're working on a race, organizing your community, or just trying to win the argument in your group chat. So if you're listening to this, hit pause, go to your browser, and head to crooked.com/yeswedan, because I have a special offer for Crooked Media fans. You'll get 20% off a Message Box for an entire year. So go to crooked.com/yeswedan.
Speaking of government regulation and oversight, something we've talked a lot about is oversight of prisons and jails in our country and where government tends to, I would say, essentially abdicate its responsibility to keep citizens who are incarcerated safe. And so my news this week is about a prison assault and death that an inmate confessed to. And that it looks like the guards in the Mississippi prison where this happened and the medical examiner have, for all intents and purposes, helped cover up, right? So this is the story about the death of William Wade Acock, who was yanked from his bed in his cell, had his head stomped on by a 26-year-old inmate named Chancellor Barong. Chancellor has tried to confess to this death a number of times, but when the prison authorities came to investigate, other inmates had already cleaned the cell, had already bleached it, cleaned up the blood, etc. The medical examiner says that William's death looked like it resulted from a fall from a bunk, which did not make sense. And so people are trying to figure out how you can have someone die in a prison facility, there be no security cam footage, no notes from interviews, guards who are afraid to speak on the record, and the state essentially say, so sorry, we had another terrible accident, when not only has the decedent's family been suspicious from the very beginning, but you have someone who has literally confessed to the crime. And so I'm bringing that here, obviously, because we talk a lot about prisons and incarceration and the way that people are treated and protected or not. Also because we had the team behind the Alabama solution on a few episodes ago. And if you didn't listen to that interview, highly encourage you to. If you still haven't seen the Alabama solution, definitely worth a watch. But bringing that here, one, to elevate the story, and two, for discussion.
So fascinated that he is saying that he was recruited by a guard to kill Mr. Acock, which is important to just repeat over and over, that he did not do this as like a, the man stole something from him, da-da-da-da-da. He's like, no, I was recruited. So one of the things that fascinated me in my activism around prisons and jails is I didn't realize that one of the biggest issues actually about conditions, the legislators agree with us about the condition stuff. They think solitary confinement's bad, da-da-da-da-da. Like, they don't think people should be locked up. Like, most of the legislators on the left, even on the right, are sort of like, it should be humane. But the biggest problem facing corrections right now is that nobody wants to be a corrections officer. So you get these wild staffing issues, and because they are nervous about people quitting, we go in and we try and put some standards in, and they're like, well, everybody gonna quit. And you're like, well, you know, the way we think about that is that we're like, well, you should actually just free everybody then. Like, let them out. If you don't have the staff to hold them, you should let them out. But the response from the system is like, you know, lower the thresholds and just have people do whatever. And it is a fascinating sort of problem. I never would have thought that it is the staffing of prisons and jails that people are afraid to confront. Even in Rikers, if you remember Rikers, the jail in New York City, there was an increase in contraband during COVID. You're like, it's no visitors. The only people going in and out of Rikers are the staff. But you ask for accountability and people are like, literally, they'll tell you off the record. They're like, people are going to quit. We don't know what to do if everybody quits. And when I read this story, I'm like, oh, they know what's up. But they are like, if we investigate these guards, this guy's just telling the truth this time. They probably have run this same scheme once a week. They're going to have to fire everybody in that building. And because the solution is not to let people out, the question will become what happens.
So anytime I hear stories like this, I kind of just automatically go back to like a media storytelling place. Mm. And I'm still kind of on the time that I was on like last year around the framing and the talking about abolition and no police and no ICE and no prisons and how that kind of political utopia or fairy tale should consistently be reimagined and given to people as stories. And this story specifically feels like such an anchor, and it makes me sad that there is not more inventive or innovative ways to supplying the story to your average person. Emphasis on average, you know? And I think the story is really compelling. I think that it shows that most of our organizations like this operate like organized crime and that there is conspiracy happening inside of jails and prison systems. And I think there's ways to talk about those things and get those things to other people to show that it's not working. Because unfortunately, if people do not see it, they just assume that it's working. And there's only a select group of people who are reading it through these newsways. So that's the first thing that came to my mind reading this was how I wish there were people who can see these stories and innovate new ways to bridge these stories to people who can change the taste for prisons and police in the culture.
Crazy times we're in.
Yes. Yeah. Now talking about somebody who needs to go to jail too, we're going to talk about Elon Musk. Elon Musky. So I'm not on X anymore. I'm not on Twitter. I'm gonna be real with you. Sometimes I have this like imaginary ancestor in my head. And sometimes the ancestor says really good and powerful things, but sometimes the ancestor just kind of gets on my neck. And it's like, so you, what you're telling me is that we killed people, we carpooled or whatever, but you can't take your ass off of X. You can't lock, you can't delete your X account. Is that what you're trying to discuss to us who are though in heaven? And it just became like kind of like an ethical dilemma for me. And this story kind of highlights it too, because it's leadership. So if you don't know, Grok is the AI that Elon Musk put on X. And part of its appeal to a lot of people is that it has less guardrails. So it can make things quicker. It's less content censoring. And that exploded because people began to tell Grok to turn people naked. And once that trend started, there was a whole lot of people. Some people were digital sex workers. Some people were people who are part of the fitness community. And some people were just average, everyday people who maybe posted their bodies. And people were requesting to show these people naked and in sexually suggestive positions. So it's twofold with Elam. First thing that he did was he did say that that's not okay to do that and that we banned Grok making illegal content. The second thing he did was get Grok to put him in a bikini. So kind of also signaling to his community that, okay, that's something I had to say because, you know, the woke fun police. But here's how I really feel about it. Here I am naked in a bikini. One of the reasons why I really like this article too is because it did have a kind of feminist critique of what was going on. I'm going to read a little bit of it. Unfortunately, the misogynistic application of tools like Grok is also no big surprise. Women and girls are disproportionately targeted with online sexual harassment and abuse, including instances that make use of new emerging technologies like deepfakes. The current surge in Grok abuse is no different, McGlynn says. The main prompts to Grok are about undressing women and sexualizing their images, such as putting semen-like images on their body. Regarding image-based sexual abuse, she adds, those identifying as LGBTQ+ are also commonly targeted. So I loved everything that was said there. The one layer I want to add, which is more layer/warning, is that's what I think we all should understand when we participate inside of social media. I think that we should start seeing social media as a social political realm in reality, where the rules and laws are different, where what you can get away with is different, and also what can happen to you is different. And I think that, and I say this all the time because I think we as Americans can stop seeing our society as a society. We just see it as the way things are. And we see North Korea as propaganda and what a weird society, but we see America as free and as free will, and it's not. So anytime we're plugging in our abs and our bodies and our diets, we're plugging that into diet culture. Anytime we are making sexually suggestive content that can go on people's algorithms, we are participating in rape culture because there are going to be people who are seeing that who did not consent to it. And then also, anytime we're uploading our pictures inside of the internet, we are giving license for people, everybody, dark and light web, to participate in that picture. And by the time somebody can say no to it, it's already done. We already know that. In the link, we're going to give you some resources. So if you find that there's been a deep fake or AI altered image of you, there's ways to take it down. But the real truth is, we already know that's how come ICE and Trump do what they do. ICE knows we're going to take Jay-Z's song. By the time Jay-Z hits us with the copyright, it's already viral. What you going to do? So by the time somebody wants to make a deep fake of somebody, by the time somebody wants to make a sexualized image of somebody, it's already done. And we just have to know that we're participating in a neoliberal fascist culture, and that anything that we add to that can be used for its benefit, even if you do not consent with it, because we have rapists and pedophiles in charge of us. And I ain't just talking about Republicans. I'm talking about all of them that it applies to. So yeah, I just want to layer that warning of anytime you log on, just because it's happening and you're doing it in your bedroom or in your office or somewhere it's familiar, know that you're walking into another social political realm where there's different laws, and act accordingly.
My macro point is that I want people to care about things before they have to, because I know some people who Grok made images of them in Speedos or thongs or jock straps. Like, that was how I saw it come up, was on Black Gay Twitter. And they are rightly outraged about it. And they were sort of like, the AI stuff doesn't matter. Like, before this, they were like, it doesn't matter. And it's like, I am nervous about all of the rationalization that happens around these things, like ICE, like, you know, until it hits people, they're like, oh, you know, this is about, and you're like, no, this is like, how do we help people understand that this is laying the foundation? That what ICE is doing now with ostensibly air quote immigrant communities is really so that, you know, when you start saying absolute immunity, it's like what Miles said, this is what we said at the beginning of the deportations. Yeah, you do have due process, but how are you suing from a prison in Venezuela? You're not. It don't matter, yeah. Right? Yeah. So, like, how do we help people understand that and like, experience the, quote, little things as really the urgent things? Like, you need to freak out right now about all this stuff, because by the time the power has been amassed in such a way, you won't even have the chance to freak out. Like, it'll be that chance will be taken away from you. So I will say a super shout out to the activists. I have like an eternal greatness for all the organizers who continue to organize and continue to push, because I remember learning about ICE for the first time because they were in a local police department, which is where I got sort of my start. I remember my first conversation about AI when I was like, oh, what is this? Like, we had used it on a police thing, and AI was going to read these pollution contracts, but like AI wasn't a thing anymore. Yeah. And I was like, oh, this feels really crazy. And I'm like, what is this? And then AI becomes a thing. And I'm sitting here like, I got to learn about this. But how do we help people understand the regulation part of this is like a real thing, is part of my homework.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. It feels like maybe a little bit of cynicism and nihilism seeping in to my brain, right? Because I'm like, well, sure, I could like not post that picture of myself in a swimsuit to give people more fodder. I could, all of these things. And the truth of the matter is, like, none of that is going to shield me from this potentially happening to me, right? And so, and then to your point, Miles, about the Elon Musk picture, right? What he's doing is like, isn't this this silly, harmful thing? I mean, haha, right? Like, those people over there are overreacting. There's no world in which this leads to violence. There's no world in which this leads to exploitation. And I am struggling with what to do about it. Increasingly, my friends are pulling their kids off social media and like not posting their children anymore. You know, you used to get on Facebook, post your family reunion picture, all the kids would be in the front. And increasingly, people are understanding the dangers of that, of like uploading the images of children online. But I'm also curious about, you know, like, there are Google albums and like my iPhone album, and like my iPhone is organizing these things, and they're like, here are these people who are in your, and I just don't know where any of that stuff goes or where it lives, right? Like, I get the thing, your iCloud storage is almost full, and I'm like, well, how do I get into my iCloud storage to figure out what's in there so I can delete some of that stuff, right? And so I think they're just like very basic things, and then the terms and services are always updating, and you're like, I'm clicking yes, because otherwise I can't use my phone today, you know? And I just think we've handed over a ton to the tech overlords that, yes, some of it is about us giving it to them by uploading it, but some of it feels like increasingly they're coming into our devices to take it.
Yeah, they're patriarchs, right? They're patriarchs. They're at least colluding. I don't want to call Mark Zuckerberg or anything like that like rapists or whatever, but they're colluding with rapists. They're colluding with people who don't care about consent, and they're colluding with people who have greed. And like, I mean, I think the hard thing is anybody who's saying the answer is not to log off is full of shit. Like, that's what has to happen. So we have to contend with where we really are, where it's like, oh, I know I need to log off. That's how it has to go. I think that's, we sometimes want to perform doing the good thing, and it becomes all about not going to Target. And we don't really talk to the person who's having a hard time not going to Target. Not because they can't not go to Target, because it's habit, or the abusive relationship we are with convenience and with connection and with social mobility and connection that happens through the digital space. We have to talk about it, because there's really no reason anybody should be logging into X. There's really no reason anybody should be logging into Instagram. There's really no reason anybody should be giving Amazon or Netflix money if you know fully that you are paying somebody to oppress you. That means that we are addicted to something, and we got to figure that out.
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Stay tuned, there's more to come. This episode is brought to you by Strawberry.me. You know that feeling when a new year starts and you tell yourself, okay, this is a year work is going to be great. And then 2 weeks later, you're already burned out. I've been there before. If work left you drained last year, today's sponsor, Strawberry.me, can help you change that. Strawberry is career coaching that gets to the real source of your burnout, whether it's too much on your plate, no boundaries, a tough manager, or just feeling totally disconnected from the work you do. A coach helps you figure out what's draining you, build habits that protect your energy, redesign your day-to-day so it feels sustainable, and they can help you create a plan so burnout doesn't come back by March. It's not therapy, but honestly, it's like therapy for your career. And here's the good part. You can get matched with a coach who fits your personality and goals in just a few minutes. Sessions are flexible, private, and made for real people with real jobs, not the fantasy version of you that always has it together. If you're listening to this thinking, yep, I'm burned out, let this be your New Year reset. Go to strawberry.me/PSDP and try your first coaching session for 50% off. That's strawberry.me/PSDP.
you love Positive America and want more of my political analysis, you should subscribe to my newsletter, The Message Box. I'm Dan Pfeiffer, former senior advisor to Barack Obama, and in Message Box, I break down what's actually happening in politics and what it's going to take to beat Donald Trump and MAGA. If you follow every poll and every twist and turn in the campaign, Message Box is for you. This isn't just hot takes. Every edition delivers clear analysis, behind-the-scenes insight, and practical strategy you can actually use, whether you're working on a race, organizing your community, or just trying to win the argument in your group chat. So if you're listening to this, hit pause, go to your browser, and head to crooked.com/yeswedan, because I have a special offer for Crooked Media fans. You'll get 20% off a Message Box for an entire year. So go to crooked.com/yeswedan.
On today's show, I'm joined by Brooke Butler, political director of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. Brooke oversees strategy to help Democrats compete and win in congressional races across the country, and she's leading a new effort called Our Power, Our Country. The program represents the earliest ever investment by House Democrats to engage voters of color and rural voters ahead of the 2026 midterms. In this conversation, we talk about what it takes to build lasting political power, how campaigns are thinking about persuasion and turnout right now, and what meaningful engagement with communities actually looks like beyond election season. Let's go. Brooke, thanks so much for joining us today on Pod Save the People.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with your story. How did you get into politics? Did you know you always wanted to be in politics? Did you get swept up by an issue? Like, what was the thing? Or did you get like a one job and then it just ballooned into a career?
A little bit of all of it. So I always had a bit of an interest. My grandfather served in Vietnam. And so growing up, he was always very adamant about how important it was to engage in politics and know what was going on around you, what decisions your government was making because of the impact it would have on your life. When I was in high school, I went to public schools, and we had a school levy that didn't pass. And so the school ended up having to institute things like pay to play, which meant that particularly for students like me, was less access to arts and activities and things like that, just because of the cost could become a barrier to entry. And so from that, I actually started to organize around the school levy. So me and other folks who were in high school, knocking doors, writing letters to the editor, things like that, to get it to pass. So the third time was a charm, and the levy ended up passing. And so the school was, at that time, actually about to be taken over by the state, although it was still a good school district just because of the budget cuts. So that stopped that from happening. We built a new high school, which I think students still go to today.
Boop, 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 boop.
And so it really taught me about how you can affect change by taking action and getting involved. And obviously the impact of voting, even though I couldn't vote yet. And then, you know, like a lot of millennials in the Obama era, you know, everything was exciting. And I volunteered for the reelect while I was in college and ended up really just getting bit by the campaign bug. Enjoyed, you know, talking to people, knocking doors, strategizing and understanding how we go about winning. And from there, it just, you know, moved to DC, got a few different jobs, moved up in politics, and it's become a career.
I love it. Now, we don't have a lot of people from the traditional political orgs one, mostly because the podcast has been around for a while. And I'm like, oh, we've already heard this story. But I wanted to talk to you today because we haven't heard the story of the DCCC. And I'm interested in this new commitment around engaging people of color. But before we do that, can you just tell people, what is the DCCC? Is it the DNC? Is it the DCSC or whatever the other thing is? Like, help put it in context so people know what it is.
Yes. So we are all under the DNC umbrella as the national committee, but the DCCC or DTRIP, it is sometimes called, is the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. So we are the House Democratic arm, and our role is specifically to flip or hold the House. Right now, our goal is to flip the House, get to 218, and be a check on the Trump administration as they look to harm more and more Americans with every policy they enact. And so we do a lot of things from the committee that looks like obviously recruiting candidates, helping folks to run their campaigns, and we focus on the majority making districts across the country. And so right now that is about 24 incumbent seats and almost 40 seats that we are hoping to flip this cycle, and maybe more than that as we get into the on year and we hopefully have some more opportunity. So.
Okay, can you zoom out though and tell people how close are we to 218? Like what's the current landscape for people that don't know the numbers?
Yeah, so While we technically have 215, while we are still waiting on the Texas 18 runoff to fill our last seat, but we need to net 3 seats in order to flip the House here. Now, as people may or may not be tracking, Republicans are doing everything they can to cheat and stop that from happening. They've started to, you know, try to rig maps. Obviously, Texas was a major gerrymander as they look to stop us from being able to win if they could, right? I know Florida is in the process of talking about redistricting. The Trump administration is pressuring places like Indiana to try to do so. And so they're trying everything they can to make it harder. But we held Republicans to the slimmest majority in history last cycle and even netted a seat in what was a tough environment for Democrats. And so we really see the opportunity to win it all back this time around. And we look forward to doing that. You know, again, the goal of the DCCC and the kind of, you know, at this point, I know every election cycle people say that, but it really is like, you know, fight of our lives when it comes to what's at stake. And what I think is another version of the redemption era as we look at some of the attacks the Trump administration is making right now. So,
and is 218 possible? Like, what's the pathway to 218? Because, you know, our listeners have heard about, obviously, Congress is, you know, Speaker Johnson is doing whatever he wants and da-da-da-da, and there's nobody, a check on Trump. But I don't know if people think that 218 is actually possible. So can you tell us the real?
Oh, it is more than possible. As I noted, you know, we have 40 seats nearly on our map that we are hoping to flip, right? And some really strong candidates in places that I think we later on could bring onto what is our House battlefield. And if you go to our website, all of those districts are listed.
Wait, tell us the website.
DCCC.org.
You say it like the people know.
Yes,
the people
that's right.
Know.
That's fair. No, that's fair. And so you look at some of the overperformances we are having, right? We just had a special election in Tennessee where the Democratic candidate is a seat that elected Trump by about 22 points. And they shifted that margin by about 13, right? And if most of our seats were able to flip at that level, we'd win more than enough seats to win back the House. On average, we are overperforming at about 15 when you look at some of the special elections across the country for Democrats. And that puts us squarely in position to flip and hold the House, I think, in come 2028. In addition to that, you know, programs like Our Power, Our Country help to get us there because we understand that our path will run through a lot of rural areas. It will require meeting goals and maximizing support with Black and Brown voters across the country. And that's how we plan to do it. So our pathway looks very different than I think some people might expect, right? There are the battleground states that most people are familiar with. We have House seats there, places like Pennsylvania, Michigan, Arizona. But you also have places like Tennessee, like Florida, like Ohio, where, you know, people haven't seen Democrats necessarily or don't believe Democrats necessarily invest or even show up in a major way where we feel confident about our path and ability to win.
Boom. Okay. Last question before we talk about the new initiative is, are there any districts or people that we should generally be paying attention to?
Wow. I mean, so one, we have some awesome incumbents across the country, right? So we have our frontline seats, which what we call our incumbent protection program. There are 24 of them. Again, they're all, if you go to dccc.org, you can check out every single one. But you have people like Congressman Don Davis, who, as I noted in redistricting, had his seat gerrymandered, but feel confident about his ability to still hold that seat and run a strong race. We have the longest serving woman in Congress and in history, Marcy Kaptur, who is in Ohio's 9th congressional district. You have Congressman Derek Tran in California's 45th, which was one of our tightest races and pickups last cycle. And it's California, so it went, you know, past November, but in the end, he pulled that one through by a few hundred votes. And so you really have some dynamic candidates across our map. And when we look at flipping, we have places like Pennsylvania's 8th congressional district, where we have Mayor Paige Cognetti running. She's the mayor of Scranton and running against a Republican incumbent who has become one of the most active stock traders in Congress. In fact, he even dumped some Medicaid stock before voting for what is that, you know, big, beautiful bill. And so I think we have places like Iowa, where you have Christina Bohannon, who's running against Marionette Miller Meeks. So we have some awesome candidates across the country that we're really excited about, and we look forward to being able to support in flipping the House.
Cool. Now let's talk about the new initiative to engage Black voters. Is it new, or has it already rolled out?
Yeah, so it has rolled out. Our Power, Our Country is the name of our initiative. It is are an eight-figure investment dedicated to targeted constituency groups. So not only Black voters, but Black, Latino, and Asian American voters. Historically, this is actually our kind of fifth iteration of that program. We've been doing it for a few cycles now. What is different this cycle is, one, this is the earliest ever that we have not only launched the program, but invested. So we've actually been through this program communicating with voters since May. Our first ads ever ran in California in some districts targeted towards Asian American voters. And they were ads that ran in Chinese, Vietnamese, and Korean. Because it's, you know, as we know, it's not only important to show up where people are, but also in ways that resonate and in languages they speak in to build trust. And then we also added this cycle a dedicated rural program because, you know, it's very important to think about where we can build back margins as we look at some of the swings against Democrats over cycles. I think it's really important to understand why and how we can not only lose, but can do better with some of these communities. And rural communities are really important to our path to victory. And we're confident we can build back support. If you look at Governor-elect Spanberger in her race in Virginia, she was really intentional about and dedicated to even go into some of the rural areas of Virginia. And you saw that pay off in a major way. And she was able to improve support by nearly double digits. If you look at even in the Tennessee 7 special where Afton Bain was running that I mentioned, not only did she overperform generally, but even in rural areas relative to how we did in 2024, she performed by about 11 points better. Right. And so it really, I think, speaks to what happens when you invest, you communicate, and you really try to understand some of these communities that people may feel like Democrats just can't win in anymore. And so we're looking to do that with this program as well.
Now, you know, obviously, you know, I'm an activist, and there are a whole crew of activists who have in no sort of split terms, they've given up on the party. They're worried about the party, right? That people are like, you know, you look at what happened to Zohran, the party was slow to endorse him even after he won the nomination or just never said anything about him. There are places across the country where people felt like the party just left them, people of color, certainly activists. And even I think about people like my father, who does not identify as an activist, but is more worked up now because Trump is just so nuts. He's more worked up than he's ever been about politics. And he, too, is somebody who's like, the party has left us. What do you say to those people? What's the plan to engage them? Because, you know, if people don't vote, we sort of are, you know, your work will be for naught.
Yeah. So, you know, we recognize that is an issue across, you know, voters. I think in general, you know, people are pretty disillusioned with politics. And we see that in a lot of conversations. And I think it is important to restore trust. And we look to do that by, you know, showing up in places, talking to people about the issues that they are facing and showing them how Democrats can do better, right? It's not only that we are, you know, against or running against Republicans and what they are doing, but also demonstrating what our plans and values are. So things like, you know, going about making life more affordable, talking about how we've worked to lower costs. Some things we've already put into place, like working to lower drug costs and things like that in the past, but also things that we look to do when we win back the House. And I think, you know, what folks will see from us and hear more from the Democratic Party is about how we are looking to tackle the things people care most about. I think to your point about, you know, both mobilization and persuading some people, it is really important for us to continually make that case, right? We know that people don't live single issue lives. So I think it's always interesting to me because I note that some issues may be persuasive and that same person may be mobilized by something else, right? Like a lot of people right now are struggling with the cost of groceries, the cost of housing. They are going to be mobilized by just simply talking about making things more affordable because that is an everyday need. And also, that doesn't mean that they aren't persuaded by things like, you know, abortion and access to choice. And we are making sure that we can reach those communities in various ways, like through the program, as I noted, while it recently kind of launched and went live, we've been doing some work in the background throughout the last few months. So as a part of the program, we launched kind of what we are calling our engagement on the road tours. And so we had staff who went to South Texas recently, did a leadership and training summit with Democratic activists and leaders on the ground to talk about not only what the party is doing, but also hear from people about what matters to them, what's motivating their community. I think a lot of times, and I talked a little bit about my background, but as someone particularly who came up in organizing and in grassroots organizing, I recognize that it is not just about us talking about what we want to do, but it's also about listening, right? And understanding what are people actually want from us? What do they feel like they need? I think a lot of times, you know, people make the assumption that we have all the answers when it comes to what policy choices should be or what should be on the table. But a lot of people know their lives and can give you, you know, sometimes better ideas than you might think of from, like, you know, a staff perspective or even an elected perspective, because they are just facing issues. So we've done some of those tours. Like I said, we've been done some in Michigan, South Texas, as well as California. And so we're looking forward to also doing more of those and really going to talk to people directly, particularly folks who are, you know, what we would call, you know, activists or base voters or however they might kind of see themselves as some of our, you know, most invested people in this party, to make sure that they do not feel left behind the way we've been hearing.
I'd be interested to know how you have grown or changed your own understanding of politics, given you started out as a young, like a student, sort of fighting the system, and now you are in the system in some ways. I have to imagine you've learned so much or sort of grown in the way that you've thought about things. I'd love to know some of those.
Like I said, I always had an interest in politics. I think what has changed is, like, my role has been a lot more, like I said, of the majority making my work. And so when I came into politics, honestly, I started in South Carolina, so it was still pretty much fights, right? Like, it was like, you know, trying to win. At the time, it was Nikki Haley and trying to unseat her, right? So always been kind of into the tough fights in politics. I think that has stuck with me even through grassroots organizing. How my lens has really changed is really understanding how we leverage the institutions and system to affect change and the roles that everyone plays. Like, for me, in this work through the political party, I recognize, you know, the party is a big tent. That means that there will be people that I agree with on some things and people I disagree with on other things, and very rarely people I agree with on all things. And that was even true when I was in organizing, right? Like, there, you know, lots of, as you know, a lot of debates about what we, you know, should not do and what is best for, you know, the country or the organizations you are a part of. And that's always a part of any big coalition work. I think that or how I have grown most in that is recognizing the real importance of, like, the initial conversations and building alignment around major issues, right? So for us as a Democrat, particularly a Democrat from Ohio, which I always know colors, you know, what I feel is most important is, like, I'm always like, talk to me about money and jobs, like money in pockets. And how are we going to do that? Because I think that at the end of the day is what's going to matter the most to people. When we look at 2024 and the feedback people got, it was that they, you know, not only were they unsatisfied with the economic conditions that they were in, but did not feel like the message told them Democrats were going to do something about it. And a lot of people thought Trump would. I think that where we, you know, obviously see some advantage now is people are seeing he's doing something about it for the rich people. He's doing something about it for the wealthy people. The billionaires, they live in great right now. And the majority of Americans are facing more and more dire consequences. The cost of everything is going up. And he's like, okay, well, you know, I'm going to build a new ballroom. Like, that's where his priorities are. And you don't have a House of Republicans, a leadership in any way that is standing up to him or even willing to push back on any of it. And so, for me, I was motivated by the understanding that it requires power to leverage change. And so for me, what was always really important was to make sure that we understood how power was moving and who had it and how we can use it to move change in a way that benefits the majority. And I still think that is what I get to do. That's what I'm, you know, like about this work, is that at the end of the day, what we're talking about is winning. And what winning means is that we have the ability to make sure that people can afford groceries, that SNAP is not cut, that people get healthcare, that we can expand healthcare access in this country. And I think that is crucial. And I think that even when I was an organizer, I kind of felt that way. I think as I've grown in my career, it's only probably become a stronger feeling more than, I think, a big shift.
Boom. I love to hear how, like, the organizers have grown, you know, because when you start, I say to somebody who's in the street 12 years ago, and I just know so much more about systems and change now. And there's a part of me that will always miss the sort of wild freedom of those early days, you know, just the, like, take it to the man. You're like,
yeah.
You know, yeah. Like, I can imagine you fighting about that school just out there, mad. You know what I mean? Like,
you know, I've gone to a few, you know, No Kings rallies and things like that too, just because I do think there is always something to being out there with people. I think there's something I even tell staff now that, you know, when Dobbs came down, you know, and there were lots of protests, like, I think it's always important to, and that is an important part of even what this work is, right? Political is not just the electoral work, as you know, but it is the people on the ground. It's the advocacy and policy change. And we all have roles to play in what it means to make change in America.
Can people get involved? Like, how can people get involved if they can? Like, what do people need to do?
Yeah, you know, so we have races across this country that we are looking to flip. If people are interested in any of them, you could go to dccc.org. And we're happy to connect you with any of the campaigns. That is, you know, our first stop. You can volunteer right now. People are obviously, like I said, running races. They need people to start talking to people early. As I noted in our programming, we are already looking to do that. We'll be looking to hire people, obviously, for some of these roles as well as our power, our country. We also put staff on the ground in some of our districts to do particularly work targeted towards Black and brown voters and against some of the cycle in rural communities. So if folks are interested in work like that, they can also go to dccc.org and submit their resume. And we'd love to have more folks involved in work to flip the house.
Boom. Well, Brooke, how can people get in touch with you? Do people follow you on Instagram, Twitter, or should they just follow DCCC? What's the what?
You know, she follow at DCCC.
She said, do not follow me, y'all.
You know, but if people do want to get in touch with me, I'm happy to obviously share my contact information too. I don't mind that. And I'm happy to share my email address. And anyone can always reach out to me. And I'm happy to chat about winning or interest in running for Congress. If people are still looking to do that, we have some places where we are still looking for candidates. And so I'm always happy to talk to folks. Even if you think maybe later in my life I want to do it, happy to have conversations about just what that's like too. So right now Well, redistricting may change this, but in Florida, I think we're still looking for candidates, particularly in like the Tampa area, as well as North Carolina, just given, again, redistricting. There's some seats in like North Carolina's third congressional district where, and we have seats, candidates in most other places, but those would be the two that are top of mind. If you're ready to run, or if, again, if you think you might want to run later, we are always happy to keep contact and stay in touch at the committee. And I think sometimes some of the best candidates are people who were like, I never even thought I was going to do something like this. So yeah, thank you so much. I appreciate the time.
Well, that's it. Thanks so much for tuning in to Pod Save the People this week. And don't forget to follow us at Pod Save the People and Crooked Media on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. And if you enjoyed this episode of Pod Save the People, consider dropping us a review on your favorite podcast app. And we will see you next week. Pod Save the People is a production of Crooked Media. It's produced by Adrian Moultrie and mixed by Charlotte Landis. Executive produced by me, and special thanks to our weekly contributors, Miles E. Johnson and Sharon DeBossier. Our production staff is proudly unionized with the Writers Guild of America East.
The country feels like it's falling apart right before our eyes, and the people inside it are being silenced.
So we're going to East 26th Street and Nicolette Avenue, which is where Alex Preddy was executed by ICE and Border Patrol.
That is not a headline. That is a human life, and it is all happening right now.
Do you worry about your own safety being involved in all this?
Yes, but it doesn't really feel like there's another option, you know?
And of course they use a 5-year-old child as bait. And of course they're doing all these horrible, bad things because they don't know what they're doing. They've been told that they're going to get rid of the worst, then they have absolute immunity. And they've been told that nothing they do will they ever be held accountable for.
On my show, Runaway Country, we go where the headlines hit home, from communities under threat to the people fighting to be heard. New episodes of Runaway Country drop every Thursday. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or watch on YouTube.